The 2004 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 121, Noah's Flood, Modern Scholarship and Mormon Tradition, a paper presented by Dwayne E. Jeffrey.
And make sure also that you either have a name tag on you or have a ticket for this session. And if you have neither, please go to the registration table and pay for the session for entering. And I'd like to now introduce the presenter for this session. The presenter is Dwayne E. Jeffrey, and he's a professor of zoology at BYU, and he's the author of the article that was published in Dialogue, Seers, Savants, and Evolution, The Uncomfortable Interface, which was published, looks like it's its 30th anniversary this year, and it's been republished a few times. Most recently in the commemorative issue of Dialogue, I believe, for an anniversary issue that was reprinted some of the most noteworthy articles in Dialogue's history. It was done a couple of years ago. And so Dwayne is going to not be followed by a respondent, so we'll have time for some questions from the audience. We're hoping to allow about 10 minutes for that. And when it comes time for that, we'd like you to come up to the microphone and ask your question directly into this rather than repeating it, just to save a little time. And so if you know you have a question after he's done, just start lining up so we can get to these right away. All right. Thank you. We'll turn the time over to Dwayne.
Thank you, Debbie. We do have a good deal of information to try to get through this morning. We've got to cover, you know, several thousand years of human history and that sort of thing. So let's get started. I will have to try to move this rather quickly, and but please, Reed, your wife is right over in here somewhere. At least she was. Looks like she's moved now. The I need to make it clear that there are those who do have expertise in this subject, but I'm not one of them. That's a nice way of saying I don't know anything about what I'm talking about, and I want you to know that right off the bat. But it's also clear that Noah's Flood presents major challenges that we have largely ignored, and so I hope this paper will stimulate for some badly needed contributions from people who do have expertise. Three of the world's major religions, that is Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, do share the Genesis story of the Flood, but I will be looking only at Christianity and Mormonism today. The basic conception of the Flood, except for the biblical date, which is 2344 B.C., let's try to keep that in mind, 1,656 years after creation, is too well known to need repeating 4,400 years ago. So that's the time space we're looking at. It's too well known to need repeating, and it was generally accepted as literal truth in Christianity up until a few hundred years ago. But with growing awareness of the natural world, increasingly serious questions accumulated one after another, and no discoveries gave any resolution. Eventually, mainline Christianity decided that at least the first 11 chapters of Genesis, that is, creation through the Tower of Babel, including through the Flood, were not historical events in the same sense that modern society understands history. It was recognized that all peoples worldwide have stories that are handed down from antiquity, and that those stories carry very fundamental messages about a given people's ideas of who they are and how they fit into the larger world. Universally, these stories are group-centered, each group believing that theirs is the true historical story, and where deity is concerned, that they were or are the ones that are favored by the god or gods. This kind of history, I once heard it called, is cosmic history, and I'll return to that. It's history, stories that are wound together to make sense of people's lives in a given group, to make sense of their lives and their world. But it may or may not be event history, the kind of history that you and I relate to. In general, the Flood story in recent centuries was progressively modified in most quarters, from a worldwide devastation to one of more limited extent, from a violent raging of pounding waters to just kind of a float on a rather tranquil pond. It was variously argued that Noah, to whatever extent he was historical, was relating events only from his own limited perspective, and that the repeated retellings and interpretations have, as folklore always does, added innumerable new details to the story to make it more appealing, more impressive, more marvelous, and supernatural. But there have always been those who have resisted this scaling down of the Flood story, and who, despite the overwhelming mass of contrary evidence, have insisted that indeed the Flood was worldwide and killed off all flesh. Genesis. So it was commonly posited that all living organisms trace their genealogies back to Ararat just 4,400 years ago. In 1961, this literalistic... This literalistic view of the flood got major impetus with the publication of a book, The Genesis Flood, by a hydraulics engineer, Henry Morris, and an Old Testament scholar, John Whitcomb. This is the major impetus to the resurgence of religious and political activist groups that are designated collectively as Young Earth Creationists. This will be the Creation Research Society, Institute for Creation Research, Answers in Genesis, some of those groups. For today, their views can be summarized as follows. That humans became so corrupt that God killed all but eight. He killed all men, women, children, and babies, and generally all animal life with them, except for what was on the ark. Now, various Young Earth creationist authors have differed as to what God's phrases means, that he would destroy all flesh or every living substance that I have made. They have disagreed as to whether that included fish and marine mammals and reptiles or plants or that sort of thing. But certainly it includes all birds and terrestrial animals, mammals, reptiles, insects, etc. And here's a critical point, all the geological strata from what is known as the Cambrian rocks upward, essentially all the thousands of feet of strata that hold the fossil record of the macroscopic animals, all of those are said to be the product of the flood. That includes all the dinosaurs, mammoths, and other extinct plants and animals of all types. So as it relates to flood discussions, the arguments insist that the Earth is very young. Great effort is expended to discredit all the dating techniques that show that Earth is old, for instance, or to find ways to shoehorn huge numbers of species onto the ark. But new dating techniques are continually being developed, and they have a remarkable consistency which creationists have never been able to explain and so largely ignore. They're working on radiometrics right now, but there are a lot of others. The estimates of the number of species in the world has grown steadily as well. A very conservative estimate would be 10 million. I'll stick with that, even though there are estimates as high as 100 million. Can one really fit 10 million species onto a single ocean-going vessel, feed and care for them with all their often very restrictive diets or living conditions, many of which we can't even duplicate today, and keep it all going with just eight people for an entire year? The answer, plainly, was no. So the latest attempt to really defend the idea so far as I am aware is John Wood Merapi's book Noah's Ark, a feasibility study. John Wood Merapi is the way I have to go with it. There's the name there. This is a marvelously inventive attempt with bamboo tubes to carry water to the animals and all this sort of thing. And it is hailed as showing how the literalistic flood story can be understood without invoking any miracles whatever. But that is just puffery. The book resorts to miracles from front to finish. Let's take just one item, the number of species. Recognizing that there's no way that Noah could have had 10 million species on the ark, Wood Merapi proposes that Noah needed to take on only about 8,000 kinds, a reproductive pair of the dog kind, the kangaroo kind, the beetle kind, etc. Then as soon as the animals left the ark, God sped up the mutation rate by thousands of times to generate all sorts of different genes and chromosomes, then sped up the speciation rate to produce the 10 million or so species we presently have, and then slowed it all down again to the rates that we see today. Please recognize that God didn't have 4,400 years to do this either. Since various kinds of dogs, for instance, that's one kind, that'll be the jackals, wolves, foxes, fennecs, dingoes, and doles, and other kinds with their various parts have been known and described from antiquity. He didn't have 4,400 years. He had to do it in a blazing hurry, essentially a creation all over again. And since two of the standard arguments of creationism have been that mutations cannot make anything new or novel or useful, and that new species cannot develop or evolve, Wood Merapi has had to jettison two of the standard historical arguments, even to get where he is, but give him credit, he's tried. Archaeologists and historians of various ancient civilizations have added yet further challenges. The biblical account seems to be not the oldest account of things at all. Some scholars think, most apparently, that Genesis version was assembled from at least two and possibly even four earlier accounts. And as far as I have encountered, estimates are that the Genesis account was put into written form between 700 and 900 B.C. But this raises the issue of massive flood stories in civilizations other than the biblical ones. Historians have documented stories worldwide: China, Southeast Asia, Australia, the Americas. But there are also regions where they are missing. Egypt, interestingly enough, and most of pre-Christian Europe do not have those. Don't these ancient stories, however, validate the view that the flood was indeed a worldwide phenomenon, that these are some sort of collective memory from the distant past? Not really, I think, for several reasons. Firstly, we must recognize that if widespread stories from antiquity established truth, we would all believe in mermaids, mandrakes, multiple competing gods, and reincarnation, just for starters. Multiple competing gods, that is, polytheism, so far as scholarship's ever been able to determine, has a far older and a far more widespread history than does monotheism. Popularity and age do not equal truth. Similarly, floods are probably the most common major meteorological and geological phenomenon that humans experience. They're constantly in the news media. Indeed, from just a month ago, here's a modern-day Noah from India. I think the family will tell stories about that for quite a while. Meteorologists can identify with some accuracy the size of 500-year or 1,000-year type floods. It's easy to see how then, when those occurred in ancient times, some could give rise to wonderful and growing stories. And we must remember that through history, way back, we're not dealing with the same kind of weather that you and I have experienced in our short lifetime. It is well established that about 12,000 years ago, our planet was just emerging from the latest of its numerous ice ages. Sea level was hundreds of meters lower than it is at present. With the melting of the ice, sea levels rose. Humans have traditionally found their most hospitable homes in lowlands adjacent to oceans. These are ready-made habitats for massive flooding. Sea level rise, generating flooding into shallow valleys adjacent to the ocean, provide ready examples of how stories can arise. Tsunamis, sometimes called tidal waves, add further insight. Indeed, a significant portion of the alleged flood stories specifically refer to massive waves coursing violently onto the land from the sea. You couldn't ask for much better definition of descriptions of tsunamis. Further, it is now well established that huge ice age lakes, such as Lake Bonneville and Lake Missoula, were held in place by ice dams or other geological features, and that when these were breached, almost unbelievable amounts of water and catastrophic floods were released. I do not suggest that Lake Bonneville and Missoula gave rise to Noah's flood story. They seem to be slightly too old, but hang on with that one. This is certainly not definitively resolved, that they're too old. Some of us in the audience may remember the old Indian story reported in LeGrand Richard's book, A Marvelous Work and a Wonder, which purports to be the loss of Lake Lahontan, an ice age lake in Nevada. So maybe Amerind cultural memory does go back further than we can presently validate. But ice age lakes existed by the dozens in the old world as well, and could easily have given rise to their own remembered stories. So it's clear that the claimed flood stories from around the world stem from a very wide variety of experiences. Many are claimed, some are known, to be contaminations of legends of the Noachian story told by early Christian missionaries. There's a wonderful story of a missionary to the Hottentots, who asked the Hottentots some of their old legends, and one guy told him a flood story that was so like the book of Genesis that the guy got pretty suspicious. And he said, "Where did you get that?" And the guy says, "That's from my people. That's our old story." A little later, the missionary told that to another missionary, and the guy laughed and said, "I taught it to that guy just a few weeks ago." One scholar of flood accounts evaluated 303 such stories, and concluded that 35 were mere illusions with no meaningful detail. Among the 268 remaining, 77 were identifiably simple local floods. 80 were cases of inundation by rising waters, such as tsunamis or rising lake levels, as happened here with Great Salt Lake 20 years ago. 3 were from melting snowfall, like Denver's melting hail last week. 58 were about excessive rain, etc. But very few seem to resemble genuine Noachian accounts or their predecessors. Some do. Linguists also got into the game. A critical question has to do with translating the Hebrew words eretz or adamah, which are the critical terms indicating that the flood covered the entire earth. These are the words that Genesis uses to discuss those. What do they mean? It is recognized that Hebrew is a wonderful language for poets, since every word has multiple meanings, but that it makes a horrible language for precision. As it turns out, Eretz and Adama can mean anything, inclusive like what we usually mean by earth, but please remember it's not at all clear that the ancients even had a concept of a spherical planet like you and I do. There are many scholars who argue, and I leave this open to you, that the Bible writers thought in terms of a flat earth covered by a bowl-shaped firmament into which the windows of heaven were literally cut, foreign though that seems to you and me. So we must be careful when reconstructing ancient perceptions of the earth. Eretz and Adama, the earth of the Bible flood, may also mean land, nation, country, field, ground, or other designated entities. In short, those who want their flood universal can so construe it. Those who want it local have the same liberty as far as the descriptions about what was covered. So the academic world in general has concluded that the Noachian story is a legend, maybe with something behind it, maybe just hatched out of whole cloth. We do have to remember that our ancestors used to sit in the evenings in community groups or around open fires or their hearths in their homes, and what did you do? You told stories, often with musical accompaniment. Marvelous stories of the past, whether they were about great heroes or heroines or wars among the gods, family stories, great catastrophes, etc. And these stories, it is known, some of them went on and on for evening after evening, hours and days on end. They could be very long. I think we've totally overlooked the influence of those gifted storytellers, the griots or the guzlars, as they're sometimes called in some societies. But in the last decade, considerable publicity has been given to a specific event which may underlie the Noah story. Let me set the stage first with some statements from an LDS writer, Hugh Nibley. In one of his very early books, and in some of his early work, Nibley was interested in the origins of civilization. In this one, he argued that the Jaredites, for instance, were Asiatics, not Hebrews. Asiatics that were nothing more than refugees from the Tower of Babel, which then came across Asia, across the plains and the steppes to North Pacific, and then came across to this continent. And I'm not particularly interested today in evaluating the story of the Jaredites. I'm interested in what he says about the origins of civilization. Note, please, the great Babylonian civilization throughout the many centuries in which it flourished was merely coasting, sponging off the achievements of an earlier civilization. Every great national shrine of antiquity had a founding legend in how in the beginning it was brought from the air, from some mysterious faraway land. And this faraway land always turns out to have been in Central Asia. The weather of Asia is the great driving mechanism of world history. As you know, said he to the guy he's writing to, there are two classic points or centers of radiation from which all the great migrations of antiquity took their beginning. Sorry, mutation there. The heart of Asia, and to a far lesser degree, the Arabian Desert, but the heart of Asia. Now, it is a fact that in ancient times, the plains of Asia were covered with many waters, which have now disappeared, but are recorded as existing well down into historic times. All the major migrations, without exception, which repeatedly in the course of world history have changed the face of the European-Asiatic continent, have moved into the distant regions of the West from a point in Central Asia. Scholars began to suspect that both Egypt and Babylonia took their civilization from an unknown common source, which in the beginning at least united all the civilizations of the world in a single world civilization, and in which all subsequent civilizations are of which are they but variations on a theme. In my recent studies, I have tried to show that the original heart and center of this world civilization is to be located somewhere in Central Asia. Writing was already well established at the time he's discussing, somewhere in the world, and that somewhere would seem to be in the region to the north of Mesopotamia. On and on and on. Nibley is focusing this on Central Europe. Central Asia, excuse me. I'll get this right. So let us turn to a book by two world-class geologists, well-recognized individuals from Columbia University's Geological Research Center. This is William Ryan and Walter Pittman. and their book, Noah's Flood, The New Scientific Discoveries About the Event That Changed History. They're claiming this has major effects. Maybe from, well, we'll see. Did civilization begin here? So unquestionably, their point is somewhere in Central Asia, maybe, and certainly north of Mesopotamia. They are really looking at a major center of dispersal from the Black Sea. So let's reorient ourselves onto what we're saying here. Southwest Asia here, Mesopotamia here. This is modern-day Iraq, of course, extending upward from the Persian Gulf. This is lower Mesopotamia, as it is known, the cities of Basra, for instance, and news that are, you know, Najaf, cities that are much in the news. Upper Mesopotamia up in here. This area all through here and down here is the so-called Fertile Crescent. And these individuals now are focusing on the Black Sea, and particularly we want to look at these geologic features here. The Strait of Bosporus right here, which is straddled by Istanbul. This body of water called the Sea of Marmara. These through the Dardanelles connect into the Aegean Sea and the Mediterranean. And then, of course, these are at the same levels as the oceans throughout the world. Their story is going to center right here on the Straits of Bosporus. They argue briefly that to heck with the writing. Let's go to here. Their argument is that ancient meltwater lakes, which formed all over Asia, included one that was named by the Russians the New Euxine Lake. This was fresh water, because you have the Don and the Dnieper and a whole series of rivers that flow into this. They argue that before, at the height of the ice ages, the Bosporus Straits were entire, solid, but that the New Euxine Lake did have an outlet to the Sea of Marmara, the so-called Sakarya outlet here. But then, after meltwater and so on, this was draining out, but then there was a period of over 1,000 years, and this is well documented, 1,000 years of drier and cooler conditions. Cooler meant that the melting of the glaciers ceased. Drier meant there was less rain coming in. And so their argument is that the Black Sea progressively evaporated, the New Euxine Lake it was called, progressively evaporated to where it was some 500 feet below the level of the lip of the Straits of Bosporus. There is, of course, no longer any outlet. But then they point out that with increasing melting of ice waters to the ocean, the sea rose up, broke through the Straits of Bosporus, and flooded the Black Sea, which was now some 500 feet below. See if I can find myself here. It turns out that the Black Sea is what we see now in the light blue, but that the New Euxine Lake was just what's in the dark blue here. Now, remembering that this is 700 miles from east to west and 300 miles north to south, we recognize then that even this little rim along here is several miles wide, and that this extends well over 100 miles, depending on where you want to measure from up in here. Their point is then that during this cold and arid spell, the lake would have acted as a magnet, drawing animals and peoples from the surrounding areas. These peoples had centuries to establish themselves along the shoreline, probably close to the mouths of rivers coming in. But when salt water broke through the Bosporus, the valley would be flooded with a water input 200 times that of Niagara Falls. Water would have been rising throughout the basin 6 to 12 inches per day. In many areas, people would have had to move at least a kilometer, that's two-thirds of a mile, every day with their animals, children, whatever else, to keep ahead of the water. Anyone who was isolated by irregularities in terrain would move to whatever higher ground was available, but those two would soon be overtopped. There are no islands out in here. There was no escape except to move to the higher ground surrounding the valley, if one could, or to try to escape on whatever floating material you could cobble together if the path out was blocked. And if you had well over 100 miles or so on to go here, you got a major job. Well, this is ambitious. What's their evidence? I can't begin to treat it here, but let's outline some of the major points of their story. One, they did have initial seismic data, relatively primitive, but which indicated that around the Black Sea Basin, as it is known today, the lighter blue, there were steps, what appeared to be old lake beaches, liken them to the terraces that we see here of Lake Bonneville. You know, we see them around our valleys, at least five of them identified where the lake stabilized and made terraces. They could identify the similar things on the bottom of the lake. But since the Black Sea was the Soviet Union's only year-round water ocean port, it was tightly guarded. Westerners did not get access. That began to break down a little bit in 1961 when an American research vessel was permitted in for a few days and sporadic subsequent visits since. Ryan and Pittman made it known that this thing looks like an old lake. They were subsequently contacted by a Soviet geologist who had independently noticed the terraces and independently concluded that the Black Sea, by golly, was once a freshwater lake. So the two groups began collaboration. This started to give a little more information than Ryan and Pittman could get individually. Eventually, better access was possible. The lake story became well established, but it's changed from a lake to a rather salty sea, which is still today only half as salty as the ocean, was less clear. Eventually, drill corings from ships into the sediment samples were done all over the Black Sea bottom. These contained mollusks, index fossils, seashells, and in the lower sediments, only freshwater species were found, species known to live in freshwater. But then all of a sudden there's a shift, and in the higher sediments, it's all marine organisms. And whether you're drilling the deep parts of the lake or the shallow parts of the lake, all of them have the same date for that shift, 5600 BC. The Black Sea and the ocean, the Sea of Marmara, are still moving to full equilibrium of content, salt content. This is a freaky story. The salt water coming in is heavier than fresh water, and so it sinks to the bottom of the sea. This forces fresh water upward, and it has to flow out as it is displaced to the top. So this creates an incredible situation through the Straits of Bosporus. The surface water is flowing out of the sea. The underlying current is flowing in. Now, this countercurrent has been known from antiquity. It was first measured in 1680. But ancient boatmen from centuries past, if they wanted to go upstream, northward in the sea in the Bosporus, they would lower baskets with rocks from their boats into the bottom current, which would then pull them through the upper current into the sea. Recognizing that any major diaspora from the Black Sea area should result in people suddenly showing up elsewhere, Ryan and Pittman turned to archaeology. The following charts summarize the people they have identified that seem to fit that requirement, i.e., that suddenly show up somewhere else shortly after 5600 BC. To the west and the north, this is an established group, the so-called LBKs, the linear pottery farmers that move in across central Europe. The Vincas, a recognizable group into Hungary, and the Hamangians, groups into here. The Proto-Europeans, these are not given any other name other than that, but early populations into central and northern Europe, from which come modern peoples. These are the ones now to the west and north. Proto-Europeans again from there. The Tocharians are a very interesting group that move on out into Central Asia, that appear in Central Asia. The Ubaids are the forerunners of the Sumerians into the Mesopotamian area. And the Sumerians are the forerunners of the Babylonians. Then other groups on through here and so on. So these are people that they have picked out as showing up as though a diaspora of some sort had occurred. Limited linguistic and genetic evidence is also presented in their book. Their summary argument, then, is that people dispersed out from here, that the stories of that dispersion have been created ultimately into the Noachian story of flood legends. And most authors do think that the Genesis account comes from Sumerian and Babylonian sources. An Australian writer who has previous work with biblical topics is Ian Wilson, who's picked up the torch from Ryan and Pittman. His book gives extensive new evidence to bolster their position. He does argue, as the subtitle says, that it totally changed the course of civilization. Similar to the thinking that we explored from Nibley, he argues that civilization spread out from the Black Sea, from West Central Asia. He finds evidence there for such as these. The earliest, or very, very early, designed breeding of plants and animals, so first geneticists, if you will. The first writing of bookkeeping and accountancy, of major developments in ancient city building and planning. He traces religious motifs, such as the widespread worship of a mother goddess, which he claims was then squashed into oblivion deliberately by later patriarchal societies. He traces the great respect and indeed the worship of cattle, particularly bulls, and he ties this to the golden calf of Exodus. Other motifs include temple prostitution, as in Genesis, child sacrifice, as in Genesis, priestly self-castration, as referred to in the New Testament, eunuchs for the kingdom's sake, and so on. He traces a deep cultural commitment to the color red, which occurs in a variety of biblical themes, as well as other peoples around the area, the Israelites' blood on the doorposts, and so on, and other motifs. It's an interesting case. What does it mean? I don't know. I won't try. But there are detractors, of course. Most archaeologists are still a little cool to this idea, but I haven't seen any detailed refutations. A geology team from Canada has been drilling out at the mouth of the Sea of Bosporus. That's in the Sea of Marmara, but they're drilling out at the outward part, and they think they can establish that the Black Sea has had a continued connection to the Sea of Marmara through the last 10,000 years, which would negate, of course, the Ryan Pittman story. But they're outside, they're not drilling inside, and so we'll see how that goes. But the proposal does seem to be gathering a wider circle of interest, enough so that Robert Ballard, the famed undersea explorer who is credited with finding the sunken Titanic and the Bismarck and John Kennedy's PT-109, numerous other vessels, has mounted missions to the Black Sea. Everybody recognizes that the critical evidence will be whether you can find evidence of human habitation on the bottom of the Black Sea. He has found, has published, pictures of implanted timbers that are clearly worked by tools, planted in a row and so on, they're clearly not natural, stone tools, etc., that do indeed seem to show. But these are not yet extensive, and I don't know when he plans to continue pursuing the project. But even if he validates that, it does not validate the story of Noah. It only validates the story of the Black Sea. Ian Wilson. So let's turn to LDS considerations, and I'm way behind time. I've summarized here. Well, I've heard some church members assert that the story of Noah's flood doesn't seem to be a very important part of the gospel, since the LDS scriptures say so little about the biblical Noah. We have those who identify the pillars of theology or the pillars of eternity, creation, fall, atonement, but the flood does not get into that. They point out the Book of Mormon has only two mentions of biblical Noah. They're both just ancillary comments. D&C mentions Noah four times, but always in reference to genealogy or priesthood ordination. But though they accept Noah as an historical figure, it never refers to Noah's ark or his flood. Well, we could go on through, well, let's take ark. The Book of Mormon makes only one reference, that the Jaredite barges were tight like the ark of Noah. Apparently, the Book of Mormon doesn't see the flood as a critical part of the fullness of the gospel. In the Pearl of Great Price, you get some shift on some of that sort of thing. And I'm afraid I'm going to have to skip these because I want to get to other things here. So the Latter-day Scriptures, I think one can argue, do not clarify the question of whether the Noachian flood covered the entire earth. It's kind of assumed, but it never is discussed. We tend to read it as universal. But clearly we've been culturally programmed to read it that way. We have to understand that. In Moses 8:26, we do read a comment attributed to the Lord where he says, "I will destroy man from whom I have created, both man and beast and the creeping things and the fowls of the air." The last two verses of Moses assure that all flesh is going to be destroyed, but then the book closes. We're never given an account of the flood at all. So what do we do with this? At first blush, we tend to understand it as it reads, all flesh. But I don't know of anybody who wants to defend the all flesh thing these days. Young earth creationists will not. They want to say, well, the fish were not included, and sea organisms such as the whales were not included, and et cetera, et cetera. Dinosaurs are a problem. We'll soon find out that all does not mean all in all cases. And flesh has a fairly wide variety of uses, so I won't even speculate as to whether it includes whales and aquatic mammals and reptiles and this sort of thing. But what have LDS apostles and prophets done with this? I think they've all accepted Noah as a historical personage. I know of no exception. I also know of none who have publicized much in the way of trying to understand the specifics of the flood. Indeed, some have insisted that inquiring after specifics is not something that a faithful, believing person would do. It's a miracle, and you just accept it at that. But that runs into the countering counsel that we are to search the Scriptures for understanding. That we have the LDS tradition that God works through natural laws, and that our own progress involves mastering those kinds of things. So Apostle John A. Widsoe tried to work briefly with the issue. It's a one-page essay in the Imperium Era. He recognized two basic LDS complications that non-LDS commentators don't have. First, the concept that humanity was created on what is now the North American continent, and that all biblical history through the first 10 chapters of Genesis are located here, on this continent. Secondly is the idea, though not taught in Scripture as far as I can find, that the earth, planet Earth, needed to be baptized for its eternal welfare, and the flood of Noah was indeed the earth's baptism by immersion. So how does Widsoe deal with these? He clearly recognized the most utilitarian of the problems, that you've got to have massive amounts of water to be produced and then disposed of. He reviewed the possibility that the flood was merely a worldwide rain, that heavy rain blanketing the mountain slopes would fulfill the necessity of a baptism. Further, following the idea that humanity began its history in the area of Missouri, he considers that the flood had possibly flooded down, the rain had possibly flooded down the Mississippi River Valley to create the perception of a worldwide flood, and that Noah faithfully reported events as he saw them. But the one way or the other, the ark made its way eventually to somewhere in the old world. But though indicating that nobody knows the real story, he was not about to defend the literalistic view. There have been suggestions among our people that the western and eastern hemispheres were joined together at that time, so that there was no Atlantic Ocean and there is no necessity of taking Noah from one hemisphere to another. That argument exploits the passage in Genesis 10:25, that one of Eber's sons was named Peleg, for in his day the earth was divided. I'll have to skip this, but the book of Jubilees, which is a very early Jewish work, makes it very, very clear that the earth was divided refers to political divisions. It gives you the precise boundaries that were allotted to Shem and to Ham and to Japheth, and it's all local. It's not the continental zip. Hugh Nibley touched briefly on his flood in his speech before Adam. After asserting that Noah was merely describing things from his personal point of view, Nibley says, "All Noah tells us is what he saw." But he then points out that people other than Noah's posterity had survived the flood. His reasoning? Remember that Enoch begat Methuselah, begat Lamech, begat Noah. Noah is the great-grandson of Enoch. If no descendants other than Noah's descendants survived the flood, then all subsequent humans have to be descendants of Noah and of Enoch. Nobody else could exist. So why, says Nibley, does God make such a point as to promise Enoch, this is Moses 7, 51-3, that a remnant of your seed will always be found among all nations while the earth shall stand? The blessing and promise have no meaning if all nations are his descendants, argues Nibley. So, LDS commentators in general, I've indicated, other than the ones I've just reviewed here, have not developed any tradition of trying to understand the flood. Probably for a variety of reasons, one of them being the clearly indefensible date. A few years ago, an LDS writer... Skip it. That's right. Devery reminds me I got my clock set fast. A few years ago, an LDS writer published an essay that insisted that the flood had covered mountains, not just hills, but mountains and other Hebraic literalisms. I chatted with him, and he was very insistent on what he said was the literal reading of Hebrew. And then he challenges me, well, don't you believe the Bible? And I said, well, I wonder why you ignored the obvious question, the date. And he says, because I don't believe the date. Of course, he can't believe it. The incontestable records of too many civilizations go too far back to make that date defensible. I should take note that other renditions of the Bible derive other dates, and other cultures give other dates. The Sumerians, for instance, put the flood, they have the flood. Here are the kings before the flood, then the flood. Here are the kings after the flood. But the span of time before the flood is 241,200 years. And they've added many additional thousands since. I've chosen today, with the 2344, to stick to the date that's derivable from King James and the Joseph Smith translations. So, what options are available? I think, first of all, we should openly acknowledge there's no way to defend the date, so let's not do that. It's relevant to point out that early LDS leaders uniformly had a very compressed view of time that demonstrably was not accurate. They anticipated the second coming, for instance, at dates that have long since passed us by. That erroneous conception of time seems to serve no better for the distant past than it did for the future. So we have to turn elsewhere. I think we can re-examine the question of whether the earth needed to be baptized the same way you and I do. There are those who make Mormons into animists, to be sure, that everything has spirits and so on. That's strong tradition. And they assert that the earth is a living thing, therefore... And this is the reason. It's a living thing, therefore it needs baptism. But if that is the case, clearly every living thing needs to be baptized. I don't think we want to take that on. If we choose to argue in some fashion that Earth is a sentient entity with some sort of moral choice, similar to humans, we shall find ourselves in deep water indeed. For many animals, just for simplicity's sake, have sentient capabilities far beyond anything we could likely adduce for the planet Earth. Further, it is our ecclesiastical policy that humans who lack the ability to make and exercise genuine moral decisions, i.e. mentally handicapped or those under the age of 8, do not need baptism, now or ever. But many of them surely have sentience beyond anything we could apply for the Earth. So I'm not sure what criteria we would even use to evaluate sentience for a planet. I can't find anything even remotely promising. It seems to me that the early brethren posited the idea that the flood was Earth's baptism as a way to emphasize the importance of baptism in the gospel plan. And I see no evidence that anybody ever developed the issue beyond the basic assertion. There are many other ideas from the early brethren that we no longer subscribe to, and I don't see why this one should fare any better than those. But it's argued... We tell the story so often that our children believe it. Will their testimonies be shattered to learn that maybe we've overdone it? I would hope otherwise, and that nobody's built their testimony on the flood. But certainly if there is such a risk, to delay dealing with the issue will only compound the problem. And we do have in the church a very rich history of folklore to illustrate how minor events become major ones and then spectacular ones and finally matters of testimony. We all know some of these. 3 Nephite stories and what have you. We all have ample examples that could be used to bring understanding of such mechanisms in the ancient retellings of the flood story. And this is not to ridicule folklore. As we know, folk narratives play an important role in the lives of human societies. But have we reached the cultural and institutional maturity that we can take a little longer look in our teaching at what really is event history versus cosmic history and moral illustration? Regardless of how much emotion we can generate with folk stories, and they can be powerful. I cannot see how a genuine witness of the Holy Ghost could be nurtured and expected from anything but truth. So, what are our options as far as understanding Scripture? Please remember that LDS Scripture seems to tacitly assume a biblical flood, but never says. That idea hinges basically on the Eretz and Adama and translations from the general. There are scores of other examples, including all the corrections of the JST, for instance, if one wants to look at that. And a massive universal flood also runs headlong into another idea that's unique to LDS history. As already indicated, modern young earth creationists insist that the entire geologic column from the Cambrian strata upward, with all the included fossils of dinosaurs and mammoths, the plants that formed our coal beds, the organic remains that formed our petroleum deposits, all of these were formed, say they, by the Noachian flood. This amounts to thousands of feet of sediment and fossils and coal, petroleum, and minerals. And there is no question but that a massive flood of the literalist type would carry and deposit massive amounts of sediment. You can work out the math on that thing if you want to put all that into it. But laying the fossil strata to the flood is a luxury that LDS do not have. For it is made clear in Scripture that Adam blessed his posterity in a specific small valley before his death. Other Scripture indicates very strongly that it was in Davies County, Missouri, and that this is where Adam will one day return. Very strong tradition says further that the very altar that Adam built upon leaving the Garden of Eden was still right there, sitting on top of the ground in Missouri in the 1830s. Now, clearly this topography and altar could not have survived a massive planetary flood. So, flood aside, LDS faced the problem they must account for the fossil record and the geologic strata and the flood. Some have tried to do it with the uncanonized statement of Joseph that this earth was made from fragments of older earths, that the dinosaurs, mammoths, and Australopithecines all came from other planets that have been broken up, destroyed, and recycled. What size fragments? Fragments. I've heard claims made all the way from continent-sized fragments to tectonic plates to specific geologic formations with living bristlecone pines on them to merely atoms. Suffice it to say that there is no scientific evidence whatever to support such a model and massive amounts of data that contradict it. Further, I can find no scriptural or theological support for the fragment proposal either. Indeed, quite the contrary. There are hints in the Pearl of Great Price and certainly very well-known LDS traditions that this earth is the most wicked of all of God's creations. Yet it is destined, we teach, to become a celestial kingdom. By what law of justice, then, were earths more righteous than this one destroyed to make this? In short, I can't see that the fragments theory gives us any help whatever. So what about the assumptions built into the modern revelation that Noah was historical? Indeed, reportedly, he was the angel Gabriel. And the implications that the flood was worldwide. This takes us to the mechanism, nature, interpretation of revelation. That's a topic for another day, but maybe Stephen L. Richards, apostle, can give us a little guidance. In 1933, Apostle Richards published in the Improvement Era an article entitled An Open Letter to College Students. Therein he deplores the tendency for academic persons to reject the Scriptures because of errors or contradictions of natural laws made by the writers. Hence, he says, many of the scientific world, having discovered that the earth is round and not flat, as the people of the Old Testament evidently believed, have ungenerously thrown the good book into the discard. They point out with glowing satisfaction that the God of the Hebrews is a capricious, jealous tribal God, fighting the battles of his favored people and reveling in the defeat of their enemies. And then in triumph, they point to the so-called miracles of the Bible, the standing still of the sun, the incarceration of, that should be Jonah, I'm sorry, I Finnishized it. I have a Finnish nephew, named Johan, in the belly of the fish, and tell you that all of these accounts were manifestly untrue because they contravene the known laws of nature. Then he argues that this is unfair, and he continues. So, what if Hebrew prophets, conversant with only a small fraction of the surface of the earth, thinking and writing in terms of their own limited geography and tribal relations, did interpret God in terms of a tribal king, and so limit his personality and the laws of the universe under his control to the dominion with which they were familiar? Can any interpreter, even though he be inspired, present his interpretation and conception in terms other than those with which he has had experience and acquaintance? Even under the assumption that divinity may manifest to the prophet higher and more exalted truths than he has ever before known, and unfold to his spiritual eyes visions of the past, forecasts of the future, and circumstances of the utmost novelty, How will the inspired man interpret? Manifestly, I think, in the language he knows, and in terms of the expression with which his knowledge and experience have made him familiar. So is it not therefore ungenerous, unfair, and unreasonable to impugn the validity and the whole worth of the Bible merely because of the limited knowledge of astronomy and geography that its writers possessed? These points, he then addresses the time and method of creation in the same vein, in the same article. These points seem critical not only for the Bible, but also for the Latter-day Scriptures. Every writer of our Scripture was raised in an environment, so far as we can tell, where the Noachian flood was taken with little or no question. All of them, so far as I can identify, have gone to God for information. None of them, so far as I can identify, have gone to God for information on the details of the flood. They either referred to the story anecdotally or to seek information on priesthood structure. I think the same can safely be said for the utterances of our LDS leaders who have made similar uncanonized statements. As one of our commentators put it, when God makes man a prophet, he does not unmake him a man. Similar statements can be found in many other authoritative writers, that the recording and interpretation of Scripture is not generally claimed in LDS history to be a matter of infallibility. But whether we have employed the principle of fallibility as diligently as we should may be another question. Well, so how to approach all this? I like the distinction made by a person to whom I once spoke, to return, that scriptural writers produced cosmic history, history intended to teach moral lessons. They play a lot of games with numbers in the Scriptures and make clear that deity operates in the affairs of men, and to bolster in the minds of the group's adherents a sense of meaningful place. This he distinguished from event history, the type to which you and I are accustomed, and which apparently became the norm only with the Enlightenment. Another person to whom I spoke says there's no way to understand any of this unless we learn to think like Hebrews instead of Greeks. And he says all of modern society thinks like Greeks. I confess I do. Though I try to blend the world of the Hebrews with my science from the Greeks, it seems clear that most of the challenges of our modern world must be addressed by thinking like a Greek. And let me just stop this and just summarize briefly. I am concerned among our people in trying to address current problems that face our society that they are locked into a short-term view of the world. When I first moved to Provo, they were trying to pass a bond election to fix the potholes in the streets. And I was told by several Provo residents, in all seriousness and repeatedly, that we didn't need to pass a bond election, that Christ was returning soon and he would repair the streets. And I contrasted this with the wonderful motto, the wonderful aphorism, related to Brigham: you want a heaven on earth? Then get out and build it. And that, it seems to me, is the wiser point of view. You remember that the saints were warned by the Doctrine and Covenants revelations that they should not gather into Missouri by haste or by flight, that to do so would bring pestilence. Rather, said the Lord, act upon the land as for years. Take a long-term view, and it will return unto you for your good. I think that long-term view is something that we critically need among our people to not only face realistic problems that our society faces, but to begin to develop a genuine scriptural sense of stewardship. Well, okay, my time is up. The fool has rushed in where angels have declined to tread. And so I'm looking then for corrections for people whose disciplines these more rightly are. Questions or comments from you folks? Devery, do you want to field? Yes. Do you want to come up to the microphone? I'm sorry, Rebecca.
The sad part is, give me a microphone, I never get off.
That's what's okay with me.
It doesn't concern the Noah flood, but this summer, two articles in the New Era about evolution. Could you address that?
Yes. Our church magazines tend to take what one might call an incredibly safe point of view. And so in the May issue, I think it was, right on the front, what about evolution? And therein is a story of a young lady who, you know, was challenged in her biology class. And I forget exactly how her story went, but it can be repeated multiple times from a variety of people. But also included with that was a statement from Gordon B. Hinckley. Now, this was a statement that he gave in the early 80s. He was back as he was an apostle in those days. This is not from the prophet of the church as prophet. That's a point that is a matter of interest only to academicians and historians and et cetera. The August issue contained at least a couple of letters from young people writing back and saying, oh, wonderful, wonderful, now I know I don't have to think about anything. And well, that's literally what it was. And I'm sorry that that happened. I should indicate that on the subject of evolution, back in 1992, we did get a formal packet of materials, four basic documents from First Presidency derivation, which were approved by the First Presidency of the Church, the Board of Trustees, as the Church's official position, and it leaves that open. In February of 98, I think it was, the Ensign republished the 1909 statement as though it were something authoritative. We pursued that to the top, and we were assured that, as one general authority put it to me, I don't think the Ensign's going to do anything like that again for a very long time. But we were given formal letter from the First Presidency that that was not to indicate a change in position, and assured that the documents we have in the BYU packet, which leave that issue open, are the official position of the church. Bob, I think you beat by a split second. Question is about lesson manuals that do this sort of thing. Book of Mormon one, I haven't encountered that one yet, but it's probably past the place where it should have been. I'm not surprised that it's there. These are put together by writing committees. They do carry, you know, First Presidency signature, but they really do not get a very thorough situation. You're aware that the one with Joseph F. Smith just republished the November 1909 statement without covering his later statements. Those are there. These would be quoting President Benson before he was prophet. His major one that is quoted is his speech, the Book of Mormon is the Word of God, something like this, wherein he says we must use the Book of Mormon to combat to combat the falsities and so on in socialism, rationalism, organic evolution, and humanism. He gave that many, many times until he became president of the church. And at that point, organic evolution and one other one were dropped out of that speech whenever he gave it. Yes?
What would you say is the cosmic meaning that the prophets are trying to say in telling the story?
Thank you. Missed my last paragraph there. I think the real moral of the story of Noah, I think that the brethren are using baptism to emphasize baptism. I think they're also using it to emphasize preparation of impending things and listening to prophets, listening to revelation. I think that's all there. And I would have to point out, I think, you know, the moral is a great one. Noah knows there's a problem from whatever source. He solves it however he can. We face problems. We ought to be doing the same kind of things. I think there are multiple morals to the story of Noah, but I think by leaving it mostly in primary and junior Sunday school, we miss what we could be doing with it.
But what about the original meaning? Why did they put it in the Bible?
Why was it put in the Bible? Well, of course, the Bible was put together by people, you know, several hundred years ago from whatever manuscripts they happened to have around. And there were committees that got together and said, well, I think this ought to go in. The Gospel of Thomas stays out, whereas Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John go in. The Gospel of Philip stays out, you know, all this sort of business. Those were choices made by people way back when, and we have inherited that as part of our Christian tradition. I don't know of anything that says that God inspired a group to put everything in there Indeed, Joseph says they really goofed on the Song of Solomon, for one example. Okay. Yes?
We're out of time.
Well, it's still growing. It will be important if it turns out to be legitimate. Please bear in mind that the major evidence for what that civilization was is under the Black Sea. And that's, you know, scuba divers don't get there. Indeed, we should indicate, well, it's over 7,000 feet deep, clear down to the bottom of it. But that was Lake Two, so nobody was there. But you still have to go down over 500 feet. And scuba divers can't get it because, well, they might. I can't go that deep. But it's also toxic. There's no oxygen in the bottom of the sea for reasons we won't get into. But that's why you still find these timbers preserved. They have not rotted. There's no rotting going on. Metals are probably not surviving, but wood is. I'll have to refer you to the two books and take it from there. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for attending.